Welcome to the Memory Distillery, everyone. I'm Anthony Vernary.
And I'm John Deck. Each week, we will malt, mash, ferment, and distill our way through the spirits of our past in the form of long-loved movies.
And this week...
E.T. Home Phone.
That's right. We're watching E.T. the Extraterrestrial from 1982, directed by Steven Spielberg. Man, it's weird to come full circle on Spielberg this way, especially after the first Spielberg movie that we did.
Yeah, I guess this is our last episode, right?
Yeah, that's it. This is the final Memory Distillery, everyone.
There, fanfare. Oh, God. Yeah, I really enjoy Steven Spielberg as a filmmaker. For those of you who listened to Jaws, what, like 120 episodes ago or whatever, it's been a while. I might not have professed a huge amount of love for Jaws in that show. And we're tackling E.T. now, which by all regards falls onto a lot of people's lists of, you know, their top 10 favorite movies, beloved childhood movies, etc., etc., on. But to be 100% transparent, the reason I wanted us to do E.T. is because I don't think I like it. And I feel like maybe there's something wrong with me. And so...
Well, that we've established by, exponentially. So... what specifically do you think is wrong with you that you don't like E.T.?
Well, I do have to admit, this is the first movie I ever saw in a movie theater. And so it was a magical experience, blah, blah, blah. And so, like, as a kid, I had fond memories. I had an E.T. stuffed doll, like, that I really enjoyed. Like, I was all into it. Yeah, maybe the Atari game put me off E.T. a bit, but we could get into that at another time. But... I went back and rewatched, I think it was probably around college, with a bunch of people. It was like, oh, yeah, we got to watch E.T. It's amazing. It's so much fun. I love it. And we watched it, and I was just like, this movie's just boring. And I just really wasn't into it. And I think I then might have tried to watch it again maybe a couple years later at some point and maybe didn't make it all the way through and just kind of felt like, you know, I don't know if this was the precocious, but like that bad word that means like hipster, which I guess is hipster. but no, like that part of me that
way to stumble onto it.
Yeah. Did I just rebel, you know, because so many people loved it and touched their heart? You know, I'm not normally like that. So no, it just is. It's been a very long time since I watched it. But the last one or two times I tried, I felt very bored and put off, and I just didn't get into it. So the more it just in the last like week and a half, I've like had two different times where it's come up, you know, the whole idea of why don't you like E.T.? And I feel like my reasoning is just flawed and empty. So I kind of if I don't like this movie, I want it to be because I've watched it, I've digested it, I've absorbed it, and I still don't like it. I don't want it to be just this faint memory of me just not finding it enjoyable. So yeah, I'm really kind of psyched to watch this. I know there are elements that I love. I know I love John Williams. I know I love Steven Spielberg. I love aliens. I love kid-friendly stuff. Like, there's the elements feel like they should all add up. So I'm just trying to figure out. Is it because I'm crazy? Is there something wrong with me? Or, well, you know, what's the deal?
Don't necessarily put that much on to yourself. Like, if you remember back to when we watched The Crow, like, I had that sort of same sentiment. Like, it was a pretty beloved movie, at least amongst the people who I went to high school with. And I sort of, like, went against that. I rallied against it because, oh, it's just, you know, it's the in thing to like you know, The Crow, and to think that Brandon Lee is, you know, some kind of deep whatever. And so I didn't like it because of that. And, you know, it came around. I turned a corner on it when we watched it for the show. Same thing with Romeo and Juliet. Like, I had that same sort of stance against it, like, for no other reason than because it was cool to not like it. So I think that probably now, as an older John Deck, you're probably going to turn that corner like I did on those two movies and go, yeah, okay, this is pretty good.
Yeah,
not necessarily that it's going to turn into your favorite film of all time.
So what you're saying,
enjoy it.
So what you're saying is that by the time I watch this movie, I'll understand why, like you feel that E.T. is a combination of The Crow and Romeo and Juliet.
Exactly. That is exactly the words that I said.
I'm willing to give it a shot if you are.
All right. Well, then let's go do that. We're going to go and watch it. It's currently streaming on Amazon Prime. So if you have an Amazon membership, go ahead and get it there. Otherwise, you know how to get movies. And when we come back, we are talking about E.T. John, are you ready?
Elliot.
Let's do it.
That was a quote from the movie.
It was. Good job. Welcome back, everyone. Let's jump right into it, John. If there's one thing I loved most about this movie, it was the score. That John Williams score is just wonderful.
Blah, blah, blah. Beautiful, wonderful score. But let me tell you, I've got some irks to grit.
What?
I got it, irking. Yes, sir. That's me. Time to get on the grit irking train. Toot toot grit. Okay. Because we got to address this. It's a two-parter. One is silly but important. The other is just like whatever. But I'm setting this up very eloquently, I know. What is the name of this movie?
The title of the film is E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
That's like saying the title of the movie is John Deck, the John Deck.
That's right off bothering the bat, you?
That bothers me.
Why does that bother you?
Because John? It's just wrong. It shouldn't be that way.
Okay, if my parents named me human.
Yeah.
And I was picked up by aliens and they started introducing me, hey, this is human the human. Like, that is a true statement.
But
his name, his Earth name, at least, is E.T.
Yeah, where does he get that?
I understand that he gets it from extraterrestrial. They call him E.T. for short. Like, do you not know how names and nicknames and shit work, John?
But it's E.T. They're not saying E.T., a.k.a. the extraterrestrial. They're not saying...
Well, the AKA is implied.
Okay, fine. Let's gloss over this egregious error towards humanity and alien life everywhere and get to the second thing.
Okay.
I'm not even going to say E.T.'s mobility issues irks my gricks, because that's not true. That's just a different thing. But something that bothers me about the context and continuity and what's going on in this movie is when you have the astronaut show up at the house to
encounter the
E.T. situation. I, you know, it'd be one thing if this was some sort of conspiracy and they wanted to show up and, like, you know, make the family and kids scared and tell stories about seeing spacemen and, like, oh, this is how we'll just, you know, they'll be like, no, there was a real spaceman, but then the astronaut spaceman came and took him, and, like, they make him sound crazy. Okay, yeah. But no, they're just, like, the first wave of the people who are then wearing all the, like, the biomedical containment gear. But it's, like, they show up, and they're crawling through the window?
Yeah, that was pretty wild, and, like... Not
no
just
talking,
like, coming through the window, like
arms stretched out like zombies, like,
ripping at the blinds.
Yeah.
Like, you can, you have hands, you can lift the blinds. It's like it was that entire scene was like this weird, surreal, almost like Sarah Connor fever dream.
Yeah.
That we sort of witnessed there. And you don't know for that, I don't know, 60 or 90 second stretch, whether this is real or something that Elliot is imagining, because he's just like, he's sick and he's going through it.
Yeah. So there, yes, that's, I had to get that off my chest, and that's the end of this, Gritter can change.
No. Let's spend another 10 minutes talking about the all right, NASA astronaut.
You asked for it. So,
I mean, I could go, like, what the fuck are you guys doing? Like, why aren't you showing up in biochemical gear? Like,
instead of
acting like you're doing an EVA on the fucking space shuttle.
Unless NASA suits had certain alien protection properties that no one else knew about, and they've run into other aliens before, and there's some sort of shielding in these NASA suits that has nothing to do with all the biochemical filters and stuff that the other suits have. So it's not just radiation, it's not just fear of disease. Like, they were, like, these had some sort of, like, the equivalent of laser-proof, bulletproof, you know, some kind of alien encounter protection. That's the only thing that still doesn't make sense. No, that doesn't do it.
Does it have, like, special butt guards to protect you from aliens from Uranus?
Yes.
Get it? Your anus?
Get it? Yeah, he has.
He doesn't get it, Greg.
He doesn't get it. So, John Williams is, of course, a genius. And what I love, I mean, outside of the fact that the score itself is great, especially the main theme, which is quite possibly, like you were saying, maybe the best thing about the movie. It might be one of the best main theme scores ever. Maybe.
Oh, absolutely.
Just, and it's way up there.
It's so iconic that you got to keep in mind, listener, that E.T. for probably 10 or 15 years, like, permeated a lot of pop culture, and so much so that Universal Studios wanted to cash in on that. It's being that this was their movie, they had an E.T. ride at the Universal Studios theme parks for years. I mean, like, into the 2000s, they had these rides there. And so, like, when that main theme plays in the movie, I'm instantly taken to, like, being seated on a mechanical bike at Universal Studios and going through the ride, just because it's that deeply ingrained. That particular memory is just so deeply ingrained with this auditory trigger. But it's not just the E.T. theme. Like, there's elements of Star Wars in there, with Yoda's theme kind of playing, and you get sort of elements of, like, the Imperial March or Darth Vader's theme, but then also some Indiana Jones stuff. Like, you get certain feels for, like, the slower scenes and, like, Temple of Doom and stuff like that. Like, you just really get a cross between Star Wars and Indiana Jones throughout the score of this movie.
And even the way the movie begins, again, having it been, I don't know, 20 years since I've seen it. I can't remember. But, like, this movie almost felt like Jurassic Park.
Yeah, a little bit.
The soundtrack, the tense soundtrack in the very beginning, the first 5 to 10 minutes of this movie, you know, when he's going out to get the pizza and the cornfields and all that stuff. Like, not only is the high strings just, you know, make you feel a little, like, off guard, but it reminds me of, like, the beginning of Jurassic Park when they're moving the container with the raptor in it. And, like, you know, it's like there's this connection. And, of course, Jurassic Park came after E.T., so maybe it was the other way around. But in terms of timeline inspiration. But I love those connections between the different films. And you mentioned, like, Yoda's theme. I definitely noticed that. And then, of course, it was really cool that E.T. would have the reaction to the kid dressed up as Yoda and say home because of the connection to, like, Phantom Menace.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, that's very closely tied, which I was reading up on that. It turns out it was done as a favor to Steven Spielberg, who dropped, like, all the product placement for Star Wars stuff, like all the little toys and Absolute Power and whatever. And, like that entire sort of tie-in there was a payback when they brought the ET aliens into the Galactic Senate. So like we sort of get an origin for this species.
Yeah, so it's like I really enjoyed things like that I, you know, had not picked up on before. And even when you have Michael, yeah, that's his name, doing like the Yoda impression the first time he meets ET, and ET even his like he just like his eyes get, you know, well, they're always big, but they just he kind of has a startled look like, huh? And and if he didn't know better, you might just say, oh, it's just because he's hearing a new person and, you know, he's, you know, shocked by everything at this point. But in my mind, it's like he's going, I know that voice. I've heard that. You know, like this is like I love in my head that I have this fiction that somehow this particular extraterrestrial has actually met Yoda. You know, like
which is a wild, wild thought.
And it's not impossible.
But I like the retcon that they did to make that a thing. And I only say retcon because Star Wars takes place, you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. The long time ago part of that being the relevant thing.
It's all relative, though.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I had my dinner a long time ago in a land far, far away. I mean, I guess, yeah. So getting back to this movie, we got into a bunch of stuff right off the bat, but what's your overall thoughts and opinions on the movie after rewatching it again now? Like,
so I didn't have that deep of a memory of the movie itself. Like, I knew the overall plot. I knew a bunch of the scenes, but I didn't really have the emotional connection to it, just because as far as watching the movie itself and really, like, taking it in, I hadn't done that in at least 20 years, probably closer to 30 years. So with all that said, there was a lot of emotion to feel in this movie, and I liked in particular how they worked that sort of mechanic into it and made the audience feel that way. But I'll talk about that in a minute. So, the this time around, I having felt that sort of like closer bond between Elliot and ET and stuff like that, like I probably enjoyed this viewing more than any previous viewing I had done. So, yeah.
Well, I think it's not as good as Mac and Me.
Well, clearly not. I mean, Mac and Me, if we're going to put them side by side and compare apples to apples, like, it has just, so much more going for it. It has
ET never McDonald's, got sucked into a vacuum.
It gets sucked into a vacuum. There's Jennifer Aniston dancing as a teenager.
So many
like one of her first roles. Like, there's a lot to really love about Mac and Me.
You're right. It's unfair. That was unfair of me to even bring it up. The two have no relation. But yeah, like I'm all over the place on this one because I'm just my thoughts are everywhere. I just realized that like I probably when we like recorded the before segment, I can't remember if I actually flat out said I don't like the movie or if I just said I don't know what's so special about it. And like there's something in watching it with intention and absorbing it and trying to just feel out what's going on that helped me to appreciate the movie a bit more for what it is or what it was somewhere in the middle there. And so I kind of came out of this with an appreciation of the story of kind of looking at it in a heartwarming, magical kind of way. And yet at the same time, I have to admit, it never crossed over to the point where I'm just like, I love this movie. This is great. It's one of the best movies ever. Like, I never had those feelings at all. I enjoyed the watching. I enjoyed the movie overall. I think it's perfectly fine with moments of iconic wonder. You know, there are some really good things going on here. But on the whole, yeah, it's perfectly fine and has some masterful moments. And, you know, I'm not even talking about relative effects and creature effects. I'm just talking about the composition of the entire movie. I still wouldn't put it anywhere near even Spielberg's greatest movies, let alone all great movies or sci-fi movies. So, yeah, I appreciate it more. I can understand a bit more, especially for people who have a strong nostalgic tie to it. But yeah, I did not think it was the most amazing thing ever.
Well, I mean, there's no accounting for taste, I guess. But no, I think I get where you're coming from. I don't share that sentiment, obviously, but I can see why it wouldn't be everybody's, you know, cup of tea or whatever. There's I think something in particular about this movie that sort of pushed it over the edge. I think it was the sort of uniqueness and how they approached the close bond between Elliot and E.T. Because you could easily just say that they're the best of friends and tell the audience, yeah, that's the truth. And yeah, they might believe it, but they don't feel it. And with this, they manufactured this idea of a sort of psychokinetic, whatever, connection between E.T. and Elliot. And it works. Like, it's an easy explanation to the audience that, oh, they're so close and they're so emotionally bonded because of this thing. And the audience can just eat it up because it's a mechanic that works in their head. And I think that that's probably what sort of pushes this forward for me a little bit in terms of, you know, not necessarily being my favorite movie. It's not by a long shot, but it's higher up now than it ever was before. And I think it's because of, like, just the creativity that had to go into creating that thing.
Well, and you know why that was possible, like, biologically speaking, it's the Reese's Pieces.
Holy shit. I didn't make that connection until right now.
Yeah, it was staring you in the face, but it's obvious, but sometimes you just get caught up in the other cinematic movie magic. Oh my
god, this is the rosebud of this movie.
That's who else in this movie were eating Reese's Pieces? No one.
Exactly.
If they had been, they'd all be sharing the same, you know, brainwaves and cardiac patterns and cardiac that's patterns. Right. I think that's the term.
Cardi B patterns.
Yep. Cardi B patterns. So E.T. And Yellow Bodak.
Yellow Bodak.
No, I got confused with John Williams and his score. It's, you know, it's all over the place. I said earlier, I'm going to be all over the place. And speaking of being all over the place, I also enjoyed that I don't know how to phrase this, because you have a series on Netflix called Stranger Things that itself embodies an amount of nostalgia for the 80s, and its throwbacks include many Spielbergian references, including E.T., some 100% right there, obvious, on bikes and vans and things like that. But the other, of course, like the opening scene where Elliot wants to, you know, play D&D and stuff with them, or whatever version they're playing, and that's just how Stranger Things opens up
is
with them playing D&D and then, you know, hearing, you know, something's going on. There's something, you know, creepy going on. Then Will gets kidnapped to the Upside Down or whatever. So they were just quite a few parallels. And again, it's like my mind gets wrapped up trying to figure out how to say it. Because it's like, yeah, it was inspired by this, but it's paying homage to this in the future by going back to the past. You know, like, it's all over the place. But there's no denying the impact there. And this is, I'm not going to say the first of its kind, but it's one of those, you know, back in the 70s to 80s, like, any sci-fi alien things were pretty much more about the aliens killing and murdering and conquering the world and, you know, things along that line. And here you have, you know, a telekinetic, mildly empathic botanist, you know?
Essentially, yeah.
It's just like, and so that you're already throwing everything off the rails there, and there's no big bad in this. There's no villain. Yeah, there are the NASA guys or scientists, but they're not necessarily villains. They're just, you know, they're not even portrayed particularly villainous, except for the super creepy way in which they, you know, bend blinds and crawl through windows.
No,
and
I think that this is like a textbook version of what you would, if you were to look up antagonist in the dictionary for film, this would be the photo next to it. Like it's the like picture perfect antagonist. Doesn't have to be evil. It's just antagonistic.
So yeah, when I'm watching this movie, you talked about that bond with Elliot
and right.
The creature named E.T. Ugh.
You're so fucking petty about that name. Oh my god.
I'm so angry. I'm so filled with hatred. I wish I had a friend who could heal me with his finger and make it all go away.
There's got to be a better way to say that.
Yeah. Where's Archer when you need him?
Jesus, but, John Phrasing.
Hey, Phrasing!
Are we not doing Phrasing anymore? Like, what's the... No, I think that... that bond between them is something special, not just from a, oh, that's special, but like you're saying, like just the concept, the way in which this allows the audience to connect more immediately. And I was surprised. I did not remember that this like happens so quickly and so thoroughly on this, you know, emotional connection front, to the point where, you know, almost immediately when E.T.'s in the house and he goes down to get food for him, he feels these, you know, a wave of panic or you know, something. Like, he immediately is connected in that way that he doesn't understand. And
with the umbrella.
Yeah. And then, you know, just like that instant little, you know, bit of shock there, and he drops the milk. And like, you know, so it's just a lot of wasted food in this movie.
Yeah.
It's a shame. But the thing that really gets me going is I'm watching the movie, I'm appreciating things, and I'm thinking, why didn't this go deeper? Why didn't this become fuller and more rich and have a more of a mythology and a narrative to it? And it's because it's just one movie. So I started thinking about E.T. 2.
Oh. I had to know that this is where this was going.
You had to know. It's been a while. We've done Dreamcasting, we've done a bunch of different things, but we haven't done a good old-fashioned sequel where one is not needed for quite a while.
We call this segment Unnecessary Sequel.
Unnecessary Sequel! Boom, 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 boom.
Fuck yes. Getting that drop.
I was going to say, yeah, try to turn that into a soundboard thing. I think I blasted out all the highs and lows there are. I don't know if that's
gonna sorry, be dear listener. Send your car audio bill to John Deck, P.O. Box.
Sorry, I broke your tweeter. That could be the lead-in for this show. anyway, no, E.T. 2. So I genuinely think, unlike other times when it's not genuine and it's just complete bullshit, but like, I genuinely think that they planted the seeds, get it, of fleshing out a bit more of a connection between these particular aliens and Elliot and company. And depending upon how, you know, if they had made E.T. 2 fairly soon after this, or if we're talking about like now trying to dig in, it's a bit more difficult. But I love this idea of the connection between Elliot and E.T. being explored more fully, almost like in a transformative way, where maybe they're each becoming something new, and they're each becoming like the same, like something not quite human, something not quite E.T. And they're like turning into like twins or maybe some like reverse negative twin version of each other or something like that. And like, we don't know that that's what's happening at first. And we you know, connect with Elliot maybe months, maybe years later, whatever it is. And like, there's obviously something weird going on with him physically. And like, he ultimately like ends up going into a cocoon or something. I don't know. But like, the idea of exploring, you know, like, he needs to, you know, like his older brother's like, oh, this has got to have something to do with DT. And he goes out and plays with the speak and spell or, you know, whatever, and throws out a signal, and we get them to connect again. And then this is where it gets crazy, because they, of course, from here, play a bunch of Rubik's Cube games together, eat some Maurice's pieces, and that opens up a wormhole, and we go directly into the movie Interstellar.
Whoa!
Now, have you seen the movie Interstellar?
I have.
I have too. I've tried to forget parts of it, but some of it has stuck with me. So, but we all know the plot of Interstellar is that there's these alien beings that mess with time and they eat a lot of candy. And so I figured this is a perfect branch if you want to mess with time and black holes and ETs, to really expand this universe beyond just the whole Star Wars universe and all that kind of stuff. Plus, you know what else Interstellar has in common with ET is that John Williams was alive during the same time director of both of these movies were alive.
You don't say.
I promise when I started this, I thought I had a decent idea. And and then as I started talking about it, I realized, but what do I really want to see Elliot and ET clones do? And the only real answer here, it's got to take a dark turn.
Yeah, because I mean, it's not like you could just have it end up stepbrothers.
Yeah, because it's never gonna succeed on that kind of movie. So it starts off and you think, oh, family friendly entertainment, but really the whole thing is that if Elliot and ET ever reconnect again, that they're gonna kind of like morph into this world galaxy conquering creature, and then we have to have the scientist guy who, you know, I can't remember, does he even have a name? I don't know
who. Dr. Grant?
No, in ET, the sympathetic scientist guy.
Oh, does he have a name? I feel like he does,
but he has to try to hunt them. And so he's tasked with the idea of needing to hunt and kill the Elliot E.T. galaxy killer. And to do that, he needs to get the aliens from Mac and Me on his side. And we all know they're hanging out on the set of Interstellar. I did it. I tied it all back together.
Brought it back.
Whew, that was close, but I think I really nailed it on this one.
That was a fucking roller coaster.
I'm going to have to talk to a lot of people to get the rights for all these different IPs, but it'll be worth it.
What does this movie look like if you made it today? Like, in to, not a period piece, like in today terms?
Yeah. I think, first of all, like, I think some of the concepts could be connective, you know, like this, that same conceit about sharing the heart and the emotions and stuff could still work pretty well in any era.
Sure.
I think design wise, I think plot wise, you know, like the idea of a creature staying at home, drinking a beer, and then the kid going crazy, and quote unquote drunk at school, intoxicated, like, I don't know about all that nonsense.
It had a very Corsican Brothers feel to it.
Yeah. But yeah, I think a modern take on this, you'd have to, well, whether you'd have to or not, I think it would end up wanting to be a bit more gritty, dealing with, you know, the emotional things kids maybe go through, and have some sort of growth where the alien involved is a little more interactive in helping them deal with themselves and family and culture and things around them. As opposed to this, where E.T.'s not really doing anything for Elliot other than, like, being a heart-bounded friend.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this movie is sort of Elliot-centric in terms of the sort of give and take of that relationship. I can't say that I disagree with that. I mean, I guess that the science of contacting his ship or whatever, that's something that is just sort of, you know, our technology is thusly advanced so much that, you know, it seems simple to you, but it's actually super complex. Like, you can make that argument probably.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I think most of the elements and the messages and things like that are going to transcend, you know, generations and eras and things like that.
I'm kind of disappointed that E.T.'s little contraption with the, you know, the saw blade and the
speak and spell.
Like,
the fucking umbrella.
I was kind of hoping that when it all worked out and he hooked it up and things were turned on, that you would just hear, like, do, do, do,
do. Oh, what is that from?
I very clearly did not do it with the right pitch or
no,
notes.
No, but I know what it is. It's the speaking, or not the Simon.
Do, 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 do.
Right? It's something do, playing do, on do, a do, Simon.
Do. I could see why you would say that, but no, it's from Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Oh, you know what? I probably haven't seen that since I was like 5.
Oh, wow. Well, we picked the wrong Steven Spielberg movie. Or maybe we picked the exact right one. Well, I won't get into references there. But obviously, you have movies and you have music and you have signals and communication things. And so that was the crossover there.
Yeah, okay. I got it. I do now, so, at least.
When it comes to alien movies, like, this almost feels like one of your, like, end-of-the-show questions. And it's not really quite that, but, like, there are a lot of different alien movies. There are a lot of movies with different alien, you know, just both, you know, in terms of biology and purpose and stuff like that. Do you have any
and temperament?
Do you have any, like, favorites? I know we've already done, like, Alien on the show, and that's, you know, one of my favorite type of, especially if you want to talk just mindless, you know, killer, you know, primal alien type creatures, the whole design aesthetic and all that, like, absolutely love. But, like, in any direction, are there other alien type characters that you can recall off the top of your head that you've really enjoyed or connected with or thought were interesting?
I think that at least from, like, if we look at the comedy aspect of some of these movies, like, Paul, I think, is a really fun movie about an alien, and it's super cool in my opinion. Like, I think it's a really neat movie. Other alien movies, I mean,
we already said Mac and Me, so
yeah, we said Mac, which is obviously the best. Like, we just gotta work our way down at this point. Alien/aliens, Aliens arguably potentially a better film than the original, one of the rare sequels better kind of deals.
It's like ET2.
ET2. Space Jedi Boogaloo.
Space Jedi Boogaloo. What I'm interested, like, I've said before, and I don't know if I've ever said this on the show directly, but when I think of, like, different genre movies, a lot of times the ones that I really love, I like to think of what is it I like about them and how would I do a twist on said genre. And, like, I actually kind of like M. Night Shyamalan's Signs, not because I love the alien or the alien design, but because so much of that movie is more about, like, the family and them dealing with, you know, the concept of aliens and being afraid and not really seeing what's happening and stuff like that. I like alien movies that don't necessarily have aliens in them. But you're dealing with the, you know, the impact of what it means. And like that angle, I think is really fun. And even beyond that, if you take a movie like Arrival, have you seen that?
I love Arrival.
Yeah. I like that idea of
another movie where aliens mess with time.
Yeah. And like trying to comprehend and communicate and understand, you know, if only Amy Adams had eaten some Reese's Pieces, it would have gone much faster.
Way linear. Yeah. Way more linear.
It would have all made so much more sense, so much quicker to everybody. But no, like I really think that, you know, it's great when you have a team of people who put a lot of thought into design stuff, because if you take even like more recently, like A Quiet Place, or A Quiet Place 2, like the creatures in that, the way they're designed accentuates their intense ability to hear sound so perfectly, the way they're exoskeleton or whatever cracks and reforms, and you know, like all that being very intentional to serve the main conceit of the movie, all helps build a certain amount of credibility into, you know, it's already kind of cool and fun and thrilling, but then to have the thought and the depth put in there really, to me, sells something like that. So, you know, alien movies where they just have a generic alien who just wants to kill people, yeah. Like, whatever, that doesn't really excite me too much. But it's when there's thought behind it and you have interesting human development that as a result of whether it's war or just encountering something amazing no one's ever seen before. Like, that's the kind of stuff that I enjoyed. So there was not a whole lot of that in E.T. But you got the promise of it, like the tickle of it, the idea that you have these scientists and people on patrol and listening and like, and like, you know, there are people, but we never get to see them as more than like kneecaps. We get these like low level shots of them walking around, and it's like, how come we didn't get to see anything? The closest we got to connecting to them on any level is when that one scientist guy is just like, well, I'm just glad that, you know, you found him first. It's like, yeah, that's a cool thing to say, but like, who are you? What's up?
Right.
So I do kind of wish we had more of that.
Yeah, I think that a little more development in that direction would have been nice.
Then again, it is a 2-hour movie.
Where right, so like, how much more time are we going to dump into this? Like, we're not going to have stakeout scenes where we, you know, get to learn more about these otherwise faceless secret agents that are investigating this. So time is definitely a factor, and I feel like if this movie is too much longer, it becomes a labor to watch, simply just because of how heavy the content can be, and not even in a, you know, intense, like you just talked about, like, this isn't that movie, but the emotional weight of this movie, I think, would be a little much to bear if you go on too much longer in the
department. Movies definitely, as an art form, have a certain place, and I think maybe always will, or I don't know how to phrase that, but I'm setting all that up to say that there is some part of me that finds I'm connecting more and more quite often to really well done, like, limited series on a level that make me more satisfied than most movies, just because you have that time to unfold and tell a much larger, more robust story without it feeling heavy or bloated. Whereas
a movie, it's working so well lately too. Like, I can't say that enough.
Yeah. And it's like, I can't think off the top of my head. I mean, you could say something like Stranger Things, but that's not really an alien quote movie in the same way. But like, there's not a lot of, for all the sci-fi that's out there, and there's a lot of it, and quite a bit is actually really good, but I'm just trying to think of, if you take E.T. and not even a clone of it, but just the general concept, or you know, something, you know, where you're dealing with the, you know, an arrival situation or that, but like built into a good series. I know there were a number of these that came out like before streaming was like super the format of the future. There were a number of shows on like Sci-Fi Channel and, you know, in that realm that, you know, may or may not have been kind of good. But yeah, I'm curious. I feel like there's a chance and a scope for a revival of the genre, and I'd be open to checking out.
Yeah, and I mean, there are movies that do the sort of neat boxed in sort of thing, like especially if you go back like to, you know, the Blob that we watched, or War of the Worlds, which we should watch because it I remember it being a brilliant film.
That Tom Cruise movie?
No. No, fuck that. No, the original back in the 50s. I want to say Steve McQueen, but it's not Steve McQueen.
It's definitely not. But but let's get to the real point of your question. Why don't we watch more Tom Cruise movies other than Rain Man?
Yeah, that's a good question that I don't have a great answer to, because there are good Tom Cruise movies.
Yeah.
I don't know. I got to put 60 or 70 episodes between watches with them, I think.
Yeah, that's fair.
And watch, that was probably like episode 9 or something. But you talked about, you know, stuff that maybe could do with a limited series. One that I think about fairly often is the Cloverfield trilogy. Like, I feel like you could stretch much of that into, you know, 6 or 7 or even 8 episode miniseries.
It's almost like that was what the intent was, but that's they couldn't get the money or backing at that time. So it kind of just became like a series of movies and projects, you know, like, so it's like, I wonder what the intent was. 'Cause yeah, I think the way it was set up originally and where it could go from there, there's so much potential in that. And I'm just like, I have a certain amount of fondness for at least the first two.
The third one was...
The Cloverfield Paradox one had okay. A few cool things in it, but...
I like Chris O'Dowd.
Yeah. I like, what's her face?
Oh, who is that? I'm going to pull it up.
I would butcher the pronunciation of her name if I try to do it without looking at it.
Batra.
But yeah, I think she's like awesome. That. And and she's in Loki right now, so that's cool. But
is she really?
Yeah.
I'm only in the first episode in. Oh. Is she the judge?
Yeah, she's
the judge. Yeah, okay.
Here comes the judge. So anyway, this is one of those classic episodes where we ping pong and pinball our way all over the place. But yeah, like you're like, I've not watched, I've watched a lot of anthology series, but there've been some recent ones like Love, Death and Robots. And there's like, you know, the Phil K. Dick one, like the Do Electric Sheep Dream or whatever. I can't remember the title, but like,
they're about The Man in the High Castle.
No.
Blade Runner.
Oh yeah, that's what I meant to say. No, there's a series on one of these things. It doesn't matter. The point is that they're these anthologies with very totally unrelated stories, but they're all tied to certain themes and ideas. And to do that for something like Cloverfield would be interesting, because it's like, on the one hand, do you just want to tell a bunch of different stories that take place connected to the universe in some way? Or do you just want to be inspired by the idea or concept of the alien life coming, but like, you know, just see totally different, like maybe this is an animated movie and maybe this is just some movie about farming, but it just so happens to be about aliens.
So M. Night Shyamalan's entire...
M. Night Shyamalan's farming alien movie where it was the water the whole time.
What? No.
If you just took out the twist endings of like 7 of his movies, they'd still be bad.
Yeah, they'd be pretty bad. You know what would be the worst? The Last Airbender.
Yeah. I mean, it's honestly not the worst of his movies. And that's saying a lot.
That is saying a lot because it's a shitty, shitty movie.
It's so horrible. And as all human beings who know me know, Avatar The Last Airbender, the TV series, is my favorite thing of all time. So the bastardization of it that he did in movie form, of course, really irks my grits. But
he's irking.
You can't. That can't be in there again. The world can't take it twice. But yeah, so I don't know why this became all about M. Night Shyamalan. Oh, because Aliens, and he did a movie with aliens, and now he's doing a movie where people get old on a beach, and that sounds really awesome. Steven Spielberg Jr., that's what I always say.
If you rearrange the letters in M. Night Shyamalan, it's actually what it spells.
Yeah, it is.
Don't look that up. It's not. Just don't look it up, anybody. Please. Thank you. That's our show, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to us each and every week as we distill another favorite from our past. You can catch new episodes every Monday on your favorite podcatcher like Apple Podcasts and Stitcher and Spotify. So come and check us out. Tell a friend, tell a family member, tell a coworker to come and listen to the Memory Distillery and watch some movies with us. John.
I think that's a great idea. Oh, I guess I could say that stuff about Semaphore doing our music, because they did write a song called Destroying the Evidence. That's pretty awesome. No, I'm not getting into some weird connection to John Williams and pretending that he wrote our music. That would be crazy.
That would be insane, and not a claim that you've ever made before for John Williams.
Exactly, and I'm pretty sure he'd be offended that, first of all, that we didn't include him in our ET2 must-haves. Because I really want to go a different direction for the soundtrack for that. And planning on seeing, hopefully, Willie Nelson will still be in on that and do the full soundtrack. So, and if that doesn't work out, I guess, I mean, Semaphore would be a pretty good catch for ET2. So we'll try that out. And you can email us if you have ideas about who should be scoring ET2. And send those notes to thememorydistillery@gmail.com. And also, feel free to write us if you got a birthday or a Arbor Day coming up that you want us to take note of.
You guys just missed Flag Day. It was a perfect opportunity for that.
We could have done that movie about flags, and we just let it pass by. And 4th of July, we're going to do Independence Day again, right?
Yep.
Everybody's been asking.
It's going to be the resurgence of our Independence Day episode.
Everyone has been demanding that we really dig into resurgence and not just do a little podcast about it, but to like reenact it, full costume and everything. So keep your eyes out on Facebook for
there
that.
We're sort of stretched on that because we each have to take on multiple roles. I mean, this is a very Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall sort of situation that we're doing here. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be fairly racist. So be on the lookout.
Speaking of things that are racist, you said you saw Resurgence, right?
Yes.
Is Jeff Goldblum in that?
He sure is. As is Judd Hirsch.
I'll take your stunned silence to say I should sign off after reminding everybody to also follow us, tweet us at TMDpod.
Did you not hear me say Judd Hirsch?
No, I heard you say Judd Hirsch, but you know what you didn't say?
David! No, because he died.
Remember, I think if viewers will go back and listen to our Independence Day episode, I think we kind of worked out a plan where maybe he didn't die.
The ghost of Harvey Weinstein.
I'm pretty sure it's pronounced Weinstein.
Oh no. Oh no.
Thanks
no.
again for listening. This has been John Deck.
I'm Anthony Veneri, and this has been the Memory Distillery.
David!